Welcome and good afternoon and good evening, as the case may be. Welcome to this NARSL in Action. Tonight's episode is a joint effort of NARSL and the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws, known as AXL. Due to the legislative session and holidays, we haven't had a conference call since the Halloween Marathon, and this is really gratifying. We have 215 people signed up for the call, which is an all-time record. Finding time to put these programs together is always a challenge. And we would like to have more calls, but we need more assistance than we have. If you're out there in the listening audience, have an idea for a program or would like to actually just work with us to help put it together, we would be delighted to hear from you. So contact NARSL if you want to help put together a program for your state or for your region of states. It'd be something we'd be delighted to do. And Andy, whose voice you will hear periodically, is our co-host tonight and putting the production together and making the program run smoothly. So if anything doesn't work as it's supposed to, send Andy an email.
Wow.
What is that email address? It's andy@crackpot.com or something, right?
That works. That works. That works. Thank you for throwing me under the bus. I appreciate it.
We plan to award at least one prize tonight, maybe more depending on how the program goes, but at least one. So you would need to text to be entered, and Andy is the one who receives your text. So please text, if you haven't already, 747-227-4477, and text prize or enter or something so he knows what the text is about, and he will assign you a prize contestant number, and then when we draw that number at some point tonight, you will win registration to the 2020 conference. If you've paid for our conference already, you can use it for 2021 or you can assign it to someone else. And anybody who didn't sign up, you probably should sign up because occasionally we do send out emails. I know you're already here, but if you want to get any follow-up email communication that might come your way, we won't know who you were if you don't sign up. So follow that link and sign up. Do it now. And if there's any follow-up communication, we will get it to you. Everyone who did sign up should have received a master schedule that talks about the 3 hours. And we're going to have a really filled 3 hours, particularly the first 2 hours. So the first hour's Michigan. We're going to be going through the various actions in Michigan. The second hour is going to be dealing with Georgia, particular Halloween lawsuit. Two Halloween lawsuits, and then the third hour is going to be dealing with lawsuits in the state of New Mexico and the land of enchantment, particularly an out-of-state lawsuit and other things that might be on the horizon. And for the first hour tonight, this will be the third time we've had this person as a guest, Paul Reingold, who is now the former director of the Michigan Clinical Law Program at the University of Michigan Law School. He retired from that position in 2019, and he's got a resume that's too long to read. We'd never get to the program, but the Michigan the clinical law program is quite extensive. I wish we had that much going on here in our clinical law program. Anyway, it's general practice, civil, and criminal clinic, and over the years, his students have done cases in various state and federal courts all over the state of Michigan. And Mr. Reingold has been involved in the challenge against SORA, as it's called in Michigan, since the very beginning, I think. So welcome to this edition of NARSL in Action.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you again, and look forward to the next hour.
So I look at my notes. I sure wish I could have spelled tried better. You've tried cases. So let me begin by a little bit of background. Most people listening here knows that Michigan has had litigation going for a number of years. And the case that most people are familiar with is the case from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, Doles versus Snyder. And I believe that was decided back in 2016. But the case of Doles versus Snyder. Go ahead.
That's right. Michigan, like other states, had to decide after the federal SORNA, the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, that was passed back, I think it was in 2006, and all of the states had to decide whether or not they were going to change their laws to become SORNA compliant, as the federal government wanted them to do. Michigan get around to making that decision until 2011, and it decided to opt in. It passed in 2011 extensive amendments designed to make Michigan's SORA consistent with, compliant with the federal SORNA. And almost as soon as that law passed, the ACLU and my office began planning a global challenge to the new version of SORA.
Well, that case only dealt with the plaintiffs that were named. And subsequent to that decision, a new complaint was filed, which we're going to be focusing on tonight. And that case was ultimately certified as a class action. And I can't help myself. I have to put this question in here every time we have one of these calls because new listeners. And when you file a class action, you just go in and have a little red stamp and you put class action on it, right? And that's all there is to it. And that magically becomes a class action, right?
Yeah, I wish it were that simple. You know, the first question is that my colleagues ask me is, why didn't you file DOES 1, the original lawsuit that we filed in 2012, the global challenge to the new SORA? Why didn't we file that as a class action? If we'd done it then, we wouldn't be doing it now. We wouldn't have needed to. And that goes to the strategies that lawyers have to think about in filing litigation when you're challenging a state statute. And what we did was we went out and we searched for the very best plaintiffs that we could find. We wanted people on the registry who would be tailor-made for the press, who would look great, and whose facts were excellent. And we got that. We interviewed more than 50 people, I believe, to come up with five plaintiffs in the first case. We had somebody who was on the registry for life, who had never committed a sex offense. We had a rabbi's wife who'd had an affair with a young man who was staying at her home. We had a man as a plaintiff in that case who had committed a sex offense, later married his victim, and 20 years later is still living with her and has two children with her. So these were amazingly strong plaintiffs. Problem is, when you file a case as a class action, there are two outcomes. You can win and you can lose. If you win, you win for everyone, for everybody in the class. But if you lose for everybody in the class. And so we decided in DOES 1 that we wouldn't file the motion for class certification until we knew who our judge was. And we drew a judge in Detroit. He was a very smart judge, in some ways a very skilled judge, but he didn't have a reputation for being sympathetic to individual challenges of state law. And in the end, we thought it was safer not to file that case as a class action. When you file a class action, the state usually opposes it. And what they say to the judge is, look, if the law, if you wind up holding the law to be unconstitutional, of course, we'll apply that decision to everybody. But as we learned in DOES 1, when that occurs, they might say that at the front end, but at the back end, after you've won, they come back into court and say, oh, judge, this case was only brought on behalf of five or six people, and so we're only going to apply the changes that have been ordered to those five or six people. And that's what happened in DOES 1. So after DOES 1 came down, we filed a new lawsuit. We teamed up. It was the ACLU, my office, and a private lawyer who has done class actions. That's called the Oliver Law Group. And the three of us filed a new case, basically seeking exactly the same relief that had been granted in DOES 1, but applying it to all Michigan registrants.
Well, the certification process is what trips everybody up. They mistakenly believe that it's just an automatic thing. And those motions for certification are generally opposed. And then there's criteria that lawyers have to be able to meet. And we won't want to spend a whole lot of time on it. But it's not just as easy as putting a red stamp that says class action, is it?
That's exactly right. Now, what you have to show, there's a federal rule of procedure that lays out what you have to show in order for the class to be certified by the court. And there are basically four factors. First, you have to show that there are enough people in the class that you couldn't simply add everybody as a named plaintiff. And that was easy in our case because Michigan has 44,000 people on the registry. And so the class comprises all 44,000 people. Numerosity was easy. You also have to show that there are common questions of law or fact among all the class members. And that, too, is easy. Almost everyone who's on the registry is affected by it in the same way. There may be, you know, people may be on it for different lengths of times or for different kinds of crimes. But at bottom, the effect of the registry and the legal challenges to it are identical for everyone or almost everyone. The third thing you have to show is that the named plaintiffs, that their claims are typical of the class. And that, too, was easy for the same reason that there are common questions of law and fact. If everybody is in the same boat, it really doesn't matter a lot who the named plaintiffs are as to the typicality of their claims. Again, you want the very best plaintiffs you can get. They're the ones who are going to be bringing forth their facts to the court, and so you want them to be sympathetic and high-quality plaintiffs, as it were, but typicality, too, was easy. And then the last criterion is that the named plaintiffs also have to be adequate plaintiffs. That's just a technical term that means that even if their claims are typical and they have the same kinds of law and fact issues, you want to make sure that they don't have any competing interests that would make them inappropriate as named plaintiffs. And then the last thing that you have to do is show that the lawyers who are going to represent the named plaintiffs on behalf of the class are also in a position to do so and do it well. If you're going to be representing not just five or six people, but 44,000 people, the court wants to know that you have experience both in handling class actions and experience in litigating difficult cases in federal courts, both at the district level and on appeal. And those things were easy for us to show in the class action we filed in 2016 because we'd just come off the victory in Doe's 1 in 2015. And that had gone all the way to the Supreme Court, and we knew that we were going to be in front of the same judge in Doe's 2, and he already knew us and knew the kind of work that we would do. So the class got certified relatively easily. In fact, because the claims we were bringing were identical to what we had won in Doe's 1, the state stipulated, they agreed to class certification. And that made the process even easier.
Well, let's get into the meat of this. You had, within the class action, you had more than one class. Can you describe the classes? There's a lot of folks listening in Michigan, and I'm sure some don't understand exactly which class they fall into.
Yes. When you have different legal claims that you're bringing in a class action, sometimes not all the legal claims apply to all of the class members. And that was true and is true in Doe's 2. So the primary class, the main class in Doe's 2, is all registrants. And that means all 44,000 people are members of the primary class. We also had two secondary classes, subclasses, they're called. The first was all people whose registrable offense occurred before January 1, 2006, and that's because that was the effective date of Michigan's 2006 amendment to SORA. And the 2006 amendments, although short and fairly narrow, imposed a very, very high burden on Michigan registrants. This was the amendment that created the 1,000-foot schools exclusion zone. Under Michigan law, dating back to 2006, registrants cannot live, work, or loiter within 1,000 feet of a school. And for those listening who have similar restrictions in your own states, this is a hellish requirement. We were able to show in Doe's 1 that restriction alone makes many urban areas almost unlivable for registrants. We got a map expert who showed all of the locations in the city of Grand Rapids, which is Michigan's second largest city, that would be within 1,000 feet of the school. And that map showed that more than 50% of the city area would be forbidden to register. And what's left, mostly residential areas, what's left, as you would expect, are industrial areas, outlying areas, you know, that sort of thing, because any area that's a real residential neighborhood is almost certain to have a school nearby. So that was subclass number one. If your registrable offense was before January 1, 2006. The second subclass was those whose registrable offense occurred between January 1, 2006 and April 12, 2011. And so the first date is after the 2006 amendment, and the second date is when the 2011 amendment took effect. And so that subclass covers the people who came in after the 2006 amendments were passed and until the 2011, the SORNA compliant amendment was passed. All right, so the next logical question is, why do you need the subclass? And you need the subclasses for this reason. In Does 1, the Sixth Circuit held that the cumulative changes to Michigan's law that take the form of the 2006 and 2011 amendments were so burdensome on registrants and had so little public safety utility that they rise to the level of punishment. That's a very high standard to meet, but the Sixth Circuit said that the plaintiffs in Does 1 met that standard. And if a state statute is held to be something that rises to the level of punishment, that implicates the ex post facto clause in the U.S. Constitution. The ex post facto clause says you cannot punish people after they've committed a crime. And because these two statutes, the 2006 and 2011 amendments, rose to the level of punishment and were being applied retroactively, it was as if all of those people were being punished more severely than they thought they were going to be punished, or they could have been punished, when they committed their registrable offense. All right, so why do we need the subclass? Because the retroactive application of the 2006 and 2011 amendments only applies to people who committed the crimes before those dates. As to others, those who came onto the registry after 2011, the same statute can still be applied to them prospectively because the claim was brought under the ex post facto clause, which only prevents a punitive statute from being applied after the fact, but it can be applied prospectively. And that's what happened in Michigan. The Sixth Circuit said those coming before 2011, cannot have the new amendments applied against them, but those coming after April 12, 2011, those same parts of the statute can be applied. To lay people, to non-lawyers, that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. You'd think if it's punishment for one group, it ought to be punishment for everybody. But the legal theory behind it is you can't be punished after the fact, but states can apply prospectively, very severe statutes. And as long as when the crime is committed, you know what the penalty is going to be, very harsh penalties can be upheld. And that's the reason for the primary class and the two subclasses.
Well, I'm going to deviate just a little bit from my script here. And what I'm going to ask you is, I've gotten probably a dozen emails in the last week, people saying that Michigan can never have a registry again. That is not what the courts have said, or can they say? The courts, aren't they saying you can't have this particular version of the registry? Isn't that what they're saying here?
Yes, that's what they're saying here. There was a second set of claims in addition to the ex post facto claim. So the Sixth Circuit in Doe's 1 said, you can't apply the 2006 and 2011 amendments retroactively because they rise to the level of punishment and therefore violate the ex post facto clause. In addition, the district court in Doe's 1 had found other provisions of SORA, our statute, unconstitutional on other grounds. And those other grounds apply prospectively and retroactively. So anybody on the registry would be covered by those other claims. And the other claims were kind of what you'd expect. SORA, the federal SORNA, is a very, very complex law. And Michigan's version of it was even more complex. And there were many parts of the law, maybe not many, several parts of the law, that the court said neither the registrants nor law enforcement can understand what the statute is trying to do. The main reason was because the provisions the court found were vague. So there might be a provision that says, for example, the school exclusion zones. It says you can't work in an exclusion zone. Well, what does that mean? If I don't live in the exclusion zone, but I go there, you know, in the winter and make some extra money by shoveling snow, am I working in an exclusion zone? And in Doe's 1, we had a very crafty way to show the court how difficult it was for registrants and for law enforcement to understand what's covered and what's not. What we did was we had a team of students and volunteers call police offices, registration offices, and prosecutors all over the state. And we had a set of canned questions that the students and the volunteers would ask these police officers and prosecutors along the lines of the hypothetical I just gave you. They would say, I'm going to go to work shoveling snow when there's a storm within an exclusion zone. Can I do it? I need to know the answer. And, of course, the answers were all over the map. You know, half the prosecutors said, we don't have a clue. Talk to the state police. Talk to the SORA unit of the state police. The state police, when we called them, said, talk to the prosecutors. If you called law enforcement, the local police, you'd get, you know, some people would say, oh, no, you can't work. Others would say, oh, no, that's fine. You're only going in for a couple hours, not to worry. And then the other vague part of the exclusion zones was, how do you measure whether your home is within 1,000 feet of a school, your place of work is within 1,000 feet of a school? Again, our mapping expert showed if you measure the 1,000 feet from door to door, say the door of your house to the door of the school, that's one thing. But if you measure from the property line to the property line, it's a completely different world, because many schools own a huge amount of property. And the way school was defined was not just the school building, but the property of the school. And so all of a sudden, the 1,000 feet can become 2,000 feet or 3,000 feet. And no one knew how to measure. And so the court found that the 2006 exclusion zones were unconstitutionally vague and could not be enforced either retroactively or prospectively. The same was true with several other provisions. And then there were some other provisions that the court said violated the First Amendment. These mostly had to do with internet access, use of emails, reporting, having to immediately report telephones, use of other electronic media. And the court said that violated the First Amendment. And then the third significant legal claim that the district court decided in Doe's 1 in our favor said had to do with the enforcement of SORA. As almost everyone listening knows, if you're not SORA compliant, if you don't do something that SORA says you must do, you can be charged with a new crime. And many of those new crimes are felonies, as well as some being misdemeanors. And so compliance is a really big deal. And we knew in Michigan that thousands and thousands of people were being prosecuted for violations, and thousands were going back to prison simply because they didn't register, or they didn't register on time, or they made a mistake in their registry, and in their registration. What the court said was that the statute is so long and so complicated that nobody can be expected to obey it. And therefore, the court added an extra legal requirement in order for people to be convicted of a SORA violation. And the extra requirement was that the violation had to be willful or intentional. And so if someone fails to register or doesn't supply information, the prosecution now has to prove that it wasn't simply a mistake or an honest error or confusion, but that it was a willful or intentional violation. And that, too, is a claim that goes both retroactively and prospectively. And so the last of those three claims that I've just described, those still apply and going forward to everybody on the registry post April 12, 2011.
Well, let's get to the juicy stuff. People, we've surpassed 200, so let's find what people want to know. The judge in this recent case on Valentine's Day, February 14th, issued an injunction that has not taken effect. What is the state going to be enjoined from doing, and when might it take effect? It says 60 days from a particular date. So let's get into the 60 days and what who's going to be enjoined from doing what.
Right. Let me start with the timing. In those two, it took from 2016 when we filed the case until 2020 for the case to be resolved. And that's a really long time when you think all we were doing was seeking enforcement to the class of the judgment we had already gotten in Doe's 1 on behalf of five named plaintiffs. So the underlying question is, why did it take so long? And the reason it took so long was because when we first won the case in 2016 and 2017, we first thought that the state was going to change its law. There was really no reason for it not to. And so we were kind of waiting. The defendants, the state officers in the case, told us they were going to change the law. And then I think they realized it was going to be more of a political issue than they had thought. And so they didn't do it. We then filed the case and started moving forward. But both sides, the state and the plaintiff's lawyers, thought it was better to try to negotiate a new SORA if we could. And so we wound up spending about 18 months having first monthly and then weekly meetings in the state capitol with a big group of stakeholders that included people from the governor's office, from the legislature, from the Department of Corrections, from the Prosecutors Association, victims' rights groups, registrants groups, and the lawyers involved. It was a group of 20 to 25 people. And we actually came quite close, I thought, to agreement on a new statute. But as always happens with these issues, politics intrude. And as we get closer and closer to an election, nobody from the state wants to be passing a new law just before an election, if they can avoid it. In the end, we were not able to reach an agreement. There was also an election in the middle of that, and the administration changed in Michigan. We went from a Republican governor to a Democratic governor, and you can't negotiate until the new administration has people on board. So it took a while. When the negotiations finally broke down, we went back to court, and fairly quickly the judge issued this final order. What the final order says is to the timing is that the injunctions don't take effect until 60 days after judgment is entered. And we have an order, but we don't yet have a judgment. We expect to have the final judgment by mid to late March. The court asked us to produce documents by mid-March, and my guess is that probably before April 1st, we'll have a final judgment. The final judgment will say that the state still has 60 days from the date of the final judgment to pass a new law. And if it does not, then the injunctions will take effect. All right, so let me get to what the court actually ordered. The court found that the 2006 and 2011 amendments, that is the exclusion zone and the amendment that makes Michigan's law compliant with the federal statute, with SORNA, it found the 2006 and 2011 amendments to be unconstitutional under the ex post, and it barred their enforcement once the 60 days runs against anyone whose registrable offense occurred before the April 12, 2011 date. So it means a large number of Michigan registrants are going to have no statute that is imposed on them effective in 60 days. But what I can tell you is we thought that the state wouldn't do anything at all until the 60 days ran. But last week, the state police SOAR unit sent out a memo to all law enforcement saying that anybody whose registrable offense occurred before April 12, 2011, when they come in to register, should be turned away. And that's what appears to be happening statewide. There may be a few exceptions, but almost everybody who's going in, against whom the statute is being applied retroactively, is being told they are out from under the statute. Now, some of you might ask, well, all that was held to be unconstitutional was the 2006 and 2011 amendment. Why isn't the pre-2006 law, the last version that was not enjoined, why doesn't that revive? Why aren't people still registering under that law? And that's a great question. The reason is because the court agreed with the plaintiffs. The court bought our arguments, which we thought were correct, that the amendments are so written into the statute and cover so much that if you cut out those two amendments, what's left is indecipherable. It's not as if you can simply go back to the 2005 statute. For example, the 2011 amendments created the tiers, tier one, tier two, and tier three, depending on the crime that a registrant committed. Well, if you take out the tiering, everything that was in the 2005 version of the statute becomes nonsense because there is no tiering. The court said, as a result, you can't cut out only the unconstitutional parts of the law and have anything that makes sense be left. And as a result, there is no statute on the books for those people. So that was the first major injunction, and it appears to have already taken effect because people are being turned away from the registry. I should say at the outset, that doesn't mean that this is a permanent injunction. It's an injunction that lasts unless or until the legislature passes a new statute. And the new statute will do whatever the legislature says it wants to do. If we think the new statute is still unconstitutional, we'll file another lawsuit. But if it's a statute that we think registrants can live with and it passes constitutional muster, that will be the new registration regime, and people will have to follow that regime. All right.
That was going to be my next question about: could Michigan conceivably end up with two registries? One for the people who won the relief here, who won't have to register if they don't pass a new law. Could they actually come to their senses and pass something that's mildly constitutional, and you end up with a lesser restrictive registry for pre-2011 offenses?
They could. We're hoping that they don't. And I have to say that when we were meeting and doing the legislative negotiations in the state capitol at Lansing, it was crystal clear that prosecutors and law enforcement don't want multiple registries. I mean, it is already, a statute that's incredibly difficult to enforce because it's so long and so complicated and so vague. And if you wind up with two different statutes, you've now complicated it by another order of magnitude. In my view, it would be insane for the legislature to have to be more than one statute. All right, so then the second set of injunctions are the ones that run prospectively. And those are the injunctions that say as to everybody, but especially the post-2011 subclasses, it says certain provisions of the statute are declared null and void and can no longer be enforced. So, for example, the provisions that are void for vagueness under the Due Process Clause of the Constitution say no longer can the student safety zones, the school exclusion zones, be enforced. So that means, at least temporarily, until there's a new statute, anyone can choose to live, work, or loiter within an exclusion zone. Now, again, we're not recommending that people immediately run out and buy a house in an exclusion zone because the zone could come back, but we're hoping it won't. There's enough data and modern social science research out there now showing that exclusion zones don't do any good, that we're hoping the legislature will understand that and pass a law that's smarter and simply makes more sense. The court also barred the requirement that license plates, registration numbers, motor vehicle descriptions, and so on will not have to be registered and will not have to be registered immediately. And those vehicles are regularly used. The court said that's simply too vague a definition for people to know whether or not their vehicle is regularly used. You know, if someone owns one vehicle, yeah, you've got to register it. But if you're borrowing, you know, a friend's vehicle or even regularly borrowing, you know, a parent's or a sibling's vehicle, you're not going to have to register that. The court also found, or rather entered an injunction on the strict liability issue. It said that now anybody who gets prosecuted for a SORA violation, the prosecution will have to prove, in addition to the other elements of the crime, a knowledge requirement. That is, that the violation occurred willfully or intentionally. And then the last part of the injunction had to do with the First Amendment provisions, or the provisions that violated the First Amendment. And those two had to do with immediate registration of electronic mail or instant message addresses or other designations used in internet communications or postings, the requirement to report all telephone numbers routinely used, the requirement to report electronic mail addresses and instant message addresses routinely used by registrants. And then the last one was the extension of a lifetime registration to certain electronic mail addresses and login names and identifiers. And all of those will be enjoined when the 60 days run. Again, it doesn't mean that those couldn't come back in a new statute as long as they were not vague or didn't violate the First Amendment. But again, our hope is that the legislature will read this opinion and say, we're not going to go there. The court said we can't do it, and we won't do it. But that remains to be seen.
Well, time is going to start to be an issue. We've got a little over 20 minutes left, so I'm going to try to speed up my questions. And a listener sent me a question, and it's going to be, it's a question. I'm looking for a short answer. You were in negotiations, and you thought you were very close for an improved registry that you could live with. What was that registry going to look like in terms of reporting requirements, any restrictions on people's personal liberty? What was that registry going to look like?
Well, what we were trying to do in the negotiations was make the other side understand what the modern social science research shows. And what it shows and it showed for years is that public registries, where all the information is on the internet, and public registries that are based on the offense that was committed rather than on some other measurement of whether or not the person is currently dangerous to other people, that those kinds of registries don't work very well. They you know, what the modern research shows is that if anything, those kinds of registries make the public less safe because you wind up with so many people who can't find a place to live and can't find a job and can't reintegrate with their families. And those are the factors that are most important when it comes to recidivism. And so what we were trying to do was educate all of the other stakeholders on this issue, that what we want is evidence-based legislation that will actually treat people fairly who are on the registry, help them reintegrate into the community quickly, and make communities safer at the same time. So what we were trying to do was make it so that people whose crimes were less serious or were older had a clearer path off the registry, so that there was a way to reduce the incredibly long periods of registration demanded by SORNA. We were not hard and fast on the numbers, but we were getting both police and prosecutors at least open to the idea that people who come out of prison and who are classified as low risk of reoffending shouldn't be on a registry for 15 or 25 years if we know that if they succeed in the community for 3 years, the risk of their reoffending is lower than the risk of an ordinary male in society who's never committed an offense before. And that's what we were trying to make the legislature and the stakeholders understand. And over time, I think we were getting to the point where we would have seen lower registry periods and far fewer people on the registry over time. That was the goal. Whether that will get passed remains to be seen, but that's what we were trying to do. It's common sense, right?
I'm going to try to shorten this down because there's a whole bunch of people who want to ask questions. I'm going to ask you one more question, and then I'm going to that script I sent you, we're going to skip those and go to listeners. So if the registry were best case scenario for everybody who's out there wishing for the best case scenario, if Michigan never does anything and the injunction goes into effect, can the big old bad federal government come in here and say, well, we don't care that the legislature didn't act. You will register because it's a federal law.
That's a great question. One of the trailing cases in Michigan, you know, even though we had a class action, there were a number of individuals who got lawyers and brought individual lawsuits. Now, by the end, many of those cases had been either consolidated with our class action or had been dismissed by the courts. But some of them went through to judgment. And one of them is now pending in the Sixth Circuit, the U.S. Court of Appeals in Cincinnati. And my co-counsel from the ACLU and I are filing an amicus brief in the Sixth Circuit on that issue, on that precise issue. And our brief is, we finished it at noon today, and it's being filed tomorrow. In that case, a guy filed a federal court action because he was afraid that he was going to be charged of a federal crime for not registering in Michigan, even though in Michigan he was coming off the registry because of the injunctions that were going to be entered. Well, the government came in and said, yes, that's our position, that even if the registry requires you to do nothing, you still have a federal duty to register. Our brief says we think that's wrong for two reasons. First, in order for the federal government to prosecute a crime, there has to be what's called a federal nexus, a connection to the crime. And unless the person travels in interstate commerce and moves to a new state or committed a crime that can be directly prosecuted under the federal law, and there are very, very few of those, our position is the federal government can't do anything. In addition, our position is that the federal government can't make the state do anything. So if Michigan has a registry and the injunctions are in effect and people from before 2011 can't register, we don't see how it can be possible for the federal government to say they're committing a federal crime. We think that the crime, the only crime that can be enforced that way is one with a federal nexus. So if you move from Michigan to a state that has a registry and you fail to registry, you have now both engaged in interstate commerce, so there's a federal nexus, and you're failing to obey your state registry, which itself is a federal crime, and now you could be prosecuted. But our position is that what happened in the district court in that case should not be upheld.
Your position is very close to mine in terms of the way I see that. I'm going to try to take a couple of calls. Janice, did you have any questions? We've been sitting here silently, and if not, I'm going to open it up. And if you're in the queue, please get yourself out of the queue if you're not calling from Michigan. And everybody who wants to ask a question, star six will get you in the queue. And go ahead, Janice.
Actually, I don't have any questions. I'm just going to defer.
Okay, thank you. So star six will get you in the queue. And I'm going to give preference to Michigan. If you're not in Michigan, please go ahead and drop out. All right. So, area code 734, you're on Narsil in Action with Paul Rangel.
My question is, my situation occurred in 1993 before the registry even existed. And the registry and all the subsequent amendments have been applied to me. After this court has mandated action by the state of Michigan, will I still be forced to be on the registry even though my situation occurred before the registry even existed?
Good question. That will depend on whatever the new statute turns out to be. Obviously, if there's no new statute, you're in the ex post facto class. And if the injunctions simply take effect and remain in effect, there would be no law that applies to you. And so that would be your best case scenario. What's much more likely to happen is that the state will indeed pass a new law, and it will have to decide whether or not it wants to apply the law retroactively to people whose convictions and offenses are as old as yours. The problem you face is that courts all over the country have said that as long as state law does not rise to the level of punishment and be applied retroactively, thus violating the ex post facto clause, it can be applied retroactively if it doesn't rise to that level. And so that's what happened when it was first passed, and it was applied retroactively to you. Then it was a very mild statute. The original SORA in Michigan was a private law enforcement only registry, as was true in many other states at that time. And it wasn't such a big deal. Then the legislature started piling on and piling on. And now it's a really burdensome, really evil statute that doesn't do anything for public safety, but puts people like you on it for life. Our hope, right, again, is it doesn't happen.
Thank you. And we're going to try to make them even faster. Area code 269, you're on, and proceed directly to your question.
My question is, what about when they did this judgment, was there anything in there about if you were on it for 25 years, because you were on it before 2011, then it was extended to lifetime. Is there anything about that that's in there?
If you're in the subclasses that are before 2011, then right now, there, once these injunctions take effect, there's no statute that applies to you. And so, again, if the legislature did nothing, you would simply be off the registry because there is no law. If they pass a new law, they'll have to decide what the registration periods are going to be for which people, and you will then be subject to those when the new law takes effect.
That's a great question as well. All right. We're zipping through here. It looks like another one from 269. You're on Narsil in Action. 269, 267. We'll come back to you. Right. Area code 586, you're on Narsil in Action. Go ahead with your question.
Yes. How would this affect international travel?
That's a harder question because there's a separate federal law on international travel. The big burden with international travel based on the current SORA in Michigan, this is true for international travel and for just national travel, interstate travel, the burden is that you have to tell people in advance, to tell the registration officials in advance, where you're going to be and when you're going to be there. There's one provision that actually says if you were to rent a car under current Michigan law, let's say you went to Las Vegas for 5 days and you rent a car while you're there, as soon as you rented the car, you'd have to return to Michigan because you'd have to register in person within 3 days with Michigan authorities to tell them what the car was that you rented. And then when you go back, if you have to rent a different car, you'd have to come back and do it again. But the bottom line is, if you're in the ex post facto subclass, you have no registration duties at all. And at least under Michigan law, none of those restrictions would apply. As to the federal law, I'm not conversant with it enough to be able to answer the question. I don't recall if there are separate enforcement provisions in the federal interstate law, or if it's more just like SORNA, if it simply says you've got to obey your state law, or you can be subject to federal penalties.
We're going to do another call not too distant future on international maintenance law, area code 586, and that will be one you'll want to tune into. It would be my unlegal opinion that if you don't have a registration obligation or you're not registering with anybody in the United States, that the long arm of the feds is not going to know about you because you're no longer in their system. But that's just my unofficial opinion. I'm going to go on to another call. We might have time more. We're getting up on the end of this hour. So area code 931, quick question, please.
Yes, I'm in Delta District 6, but I'm in Tennessee. How is that law in Michigan, being the, so many states within that specific court, how is it going to affect the lawsuit going on in Tennessee?
You're right. The Sixth Circuit covers Tennessee in addition to Michigan. The problem you have is that only Michigan's law was held to be unconstitutional. Now, parts of Tennessee's law have been held to be unconstitutional as well. Tennessee is also, I believe, a compliant state. The feds still view Tennessee as compliant, even though its law is not exactly the same as SORNA. But the short answer is each state's law has to be challenged on its own for what it is. The good news for you is you have great precedent in the Sixth Circuit opinion from Doe's 1 that says, in effect, if a statute has all of these deficiencies, it violates the ex post facto clause. But Tennessee's law may not have all of those deficiencies, and that would determine whether you win or lose.
Paul, Mr. Reingold, do you have?
Yes.
Everybody's going to want advice. So spend your last moments before the music starts telling people what you advise members of the class, which is every registered in Michigan for one class, and it's everybody pre-2011 for another class. What are you advising everyone to do to protect themselves?
Well, until this past week, we were advising everyone to stay compliant and to go in and register, because it's going to change until the 60 days ran. The state police preempted us and said, at least as to the retroactive folks, the pre-2011 folks, they were not, registry was not going to be open to them. But people were going in and were still worried that if they didn't, it would come back to bite them later. So we're recommending that people on their registration date go in. They will be turned away, and we're recommending that they simply get something in writing that says you were here, and that way they've got a security blanket. They've got a proof that they tried to register. As to people going forward, their registry obligations continue. There'll be the things that they won't have to do, some of the things that they had to do before that relate to the First Amendment or vagueness, but otherwise the statute will apply to them in an ongoing way. And so we're recommending that they continue to stay compliant. They urge people to do, the legislature is going to be acting on this in the next, could be in the next 2 months. And so what we want is for there to be as much good publicity as there can be. If there are hearings, we're looking for volunteers to attend hearings. You can attend hearings and not give your full name or your real name. We're looking for people to be interviewed by the press, because what we need to do as soon as possible is get the best press out there we can and put pressure on the legislature